Welcome to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Omar Khan, author of Liberating Passion, How the World's Best Global Leaders Produce Winning Results. On behalf of the entire Strategy Driven team, I would like to welcome you to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Omar Khan, author of Liberating Passion, How the World's Best Global Leaders Produced Winning Results. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag articles found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this special edition podcast, Omar Khan, founder and senior partner of Sensei International, shares with us his insights on how to liberate organizational passion, tapping into the workforce's inner energy and commitment to deliver breakthrough results. And so now, without any further delays, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Omar Khan, author of Liberating Passion, How the World's Best Global Leaders Produce Winning Results, and founder and senior partner of Sensei International, a global leadership development firm serving clients in the Americas, the United Kingdom, Singapore, Dubai, and South Asia. Omar has served as a trusted advisor to the leaders of companies including 3M, American Express, the Ritz-Carlton, Microsoft, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard. His articles have been featured in the Washington Post, Consulting News, Strategy and Leadership, Personal Excellence Magazine, and many others. Omar, welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, I am thrilled to have you on the show. I really enjoyed your book, Liberating Passion. You know, so many times I read books that talk about just one item to engage the workforce or that cause disenfranchisement of the workforce. But your book was really all-encompassing. So you didn't focus us just on one item, but you presented just a whole number of items. And I'm thrilled to have you on the show to be able to talk about those.
Thank you.
Well, the first thing, Omar, I wanted to ask you about was liberating passion of the workforce just seemed like something that every leader ought to be trying to do. So to start out with, would you tell us a bit about the tangible benefits you've seen organizations realize as a result of releasing their employees' passion?
Oh, indeed, and happily. And I would only modify that slightly as we kick off by saying it's about liberating the passion of everyone, including all the leaders. And as you say, the workforce, the leaders are part of the workforce. So I think it's very important to realize it's not something you do to people. It's something you do with people. And you have to, it's physician heal thyself. So you have to liberate your own passion so that you can model the way. But to address the question you've asked, which is what are the tangible benefits, I think one of the definitions of leadership is the value you add to the assets you've been given. And if you take that on board, then one asks, how do you optimize the value of organizational assets, all of which require people to somehow activate them, utilize them, deploy them, or otherwise? And the key to that seems to be the discretionary effort, the effort over and above what you can command or demand, but which people volunteer.
Yes.
That's the difference that makes the difference. They volunteer it when they are passionate. So to me, the tangible benefit is that every organizational asset you can think of has what I call their mainstream or baseline value, and then their potential value. And what liberates that potential value is the passion, the voluntary passion donated, offered, and volunteered by people at all levels.
Okay, that's excellent, and I have seen that time and again, but I guess I've never really thought of it in that manner. But certainly organizations that seem to me to be more energized do voluntarily provide that discretionary effort.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that Steve Jobs, somebody who we tend to think of as an iconic leader, not as a role model in every sense, but certainly somebody who's an exemplar in many ways, had this wonderful line when he said, create a cause, not a business.
Oh, certainly.
And, you know, that kind of zeal, and creating a cause is just one facet of it, but that kind of zeal is what taps people's energy, their commitment, their creativity, their drive, their perseverance. And all of that, to me, is passion when you bundle it together. That's passion made vivid, made visible, made palpable.
Absolutely. And it's really the function of leadership is to release that passion and to inspire and motivate people.
Well, another... I said one definition of leadership is the value you add to the assets you're given. Mm-hmm. Another squint on leadership is leadership is the performance that you are able to enable and empower that would not have been possible in your people but for your leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if you assume you've brought on talented people, you're not gifting them with capability. Therefore, you have to liberate it. That's why the choice of the term liberating passion. Because
sure.
If they have talent, when you liberate passion, you also release their talent so that it can operate in the best and most ideal context.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Omar, in liberating passion, you identified 9 passion liberators to combat what you termed as passion killers.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, in principle, what organizational characteristics, conditions, or cultures kill employee passion?
Great question. I started walking down this path when client after client said to me that, look, when we hire people, they're all passionate.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't hire them otherwise. Nobody would come to a job interview, listless, lackadaisical, and get hired.
Right.
Somebody
right.
says, are you excited about working with us? No, I'm really not. It's the only job I could get. Is not an answer that's likely to get you an employment offer.
That's right. Yeah.
So everybody manages their energy, manages their commitment level so that when they come, they seem brimming with enthusiasm. And yet these companies would keep telling me, give them 3 months with us and we'll suck the passion right out of them. And they'd say this, you know, almost with a bemused, bittersweet chortle. Or chuckle, as
yes.
if what can we do? And that's why the idea of companies as passion killers first emerged. And I think the root organizational cultural defect, if you will, that produces the killing of passion is companies that don't realize that the centerpiece of all leadership is the quality of interactions between people at all levels. And therefore, it is about, fundamentally about, the candor, the caliber, the quality, the authenticity of the relationships that run across the organization. So if you're a business that discounts the building up of high-quality relationships, I remember a wonderful quote that said, nothing can be built and sustained that is larger than the relationships on which it's based.
Yes.
And it's another one of those that when you hear it, you say, of course, that's true. Anything that involves fundamental change means a reliance on core relationships. You can see it in military units that thrive under pressure. You could see it in successful, say, space launches where a team has had to work together to deal with extremely trying situations. You can see it in a business crisis where people have had to turn on a dime and shift a large organization, its focuses and priorities. So absent relationships, or a discounting of the quality of conversations and relationships, you could almost predict that there will be passion killer bureaucracy and other dehumanizing aspects.
Yes, and you know, I have seen companies that I've worked with do that both physically and then and on an emotional level. Physically, I've seen them deliberately move all of the executive team out of being positioned with the workforce and
yes.
segregated in either separate buildings or in typically, of course, the top floor of the building they're in with nobody else around. And then I guess from a psychological or an emotional standpoint, they distance themselves. You know, anyone bringing bad news, it's always a shoot the messenger. It's a career-limiting event if you bring bad news to an executive. They just don't want that interaction with the workforce.
Well, I think there are two dangers. One is relationships sometimes get interpreted by people as meaning coddling. And mm-hmm. people point to bare-knuckle but highly effective corporate cultures like GE, where somebody said the biggest asset they have is there's not an ounce of denial in the place, which is a great tribute if true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen positive indicators of that with some GEers, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But relationships does not mean coddling. Relationships means literally the quality of how we relate. And that means both the quality of confrontation and challenge when appropriate,
mm-hmm.
The quality of telling truth to power when appropriate, but
yes.
then also, of course, the quality of support given, empathy provided, coaching and mentoring. So it's the whole constellation of relating to each other, which
Absolutely.
Is what I mean by relationships, and I mean communication across that whole continuum.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, Omar, in your book, to counter the passion killers, you talk about 9 passion liberators.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could just briefly describe what some of those passionate liberators are.
Sure. Well, one of the primary ones, as you'll have seen in the book, is, and the first one, which catches people a little off guard,
mm-hmm.
I call it intimacy, and that's just my take on intimacy. Intimacy is into me, see. And many times people say, well, my God, what does that have to do with anything? And what I invariably tell them is that it has everything to do with it, because how can you be passionate about being on a team with people if you don't know who you're on a team with?
Right. Right.
Right, so that's mm-hmm. the relevance. By intimacy, I don't mean a corporate strip show. I don't mean inappropriate revelations about your life and times or your, or the wounds that we picked up in youth. This is not a therapy session
mm-hmm.
necessarily. What this means is appropriate disclosure of who I am, how I operate, my red flags, my red buttons, my turn-ons, my turn-offs, so that people don't have to skirt around my sensitivities and eccentricities. In fact, being aware of them, they can call me on them, and hopefully I can outgrow some of the more limiting ones and get some compassion for those I am having a hard time outgrowing. But by doing that, then we don't all have to defensively pretend to be other than who we are. I mean, what a relief. What a relief when I can see your strengths and you can see mine. We can mm-hmm. forgive each other's weaknesses, and we can focus on something larger than either of our egos or vanity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's what that first passion liberator is about. Teams that invest a bit of this energy, though it yeah. seems odd to people, my God, the energy they save, the time they save, the miscommunication they avoid, and the passion they protect rather than letting get leached out as everybody tries to aggressively force everybody else to be just like them.
I guess sometimes when I think back of the high-functioning teams I've been on, there's that element of being invested in the other team members.
Yeah, and in their success.
Absolutely. And it's through that investment and their reciprocating investment that we come to understand, we want to understand each other and to know each other, and, you know, we kind of care about our teammates.
Right, and great teams have to know how to get the best from each other, not how to evoke the worst of each other. We all have, we all have less savory aspects of our personalities. And what we don't want is a team to be a trigger for our worst rather than, a stimulus for our best. And that's really what the first Passion Liberator is all about. How can I make sure I know who I'm on a team with? How can I understand them enough to support their success and evoke their best and help them deal with their worst when it occasionally is triggered or surfaces?
Right. Absolutely.
Another Passion Liberator that I talk about early is the right bullseye. And it has really a couple of components. One is, what is our bullseye? I mean, people used to talk about vision and mission. The problem with that is that they've become very hackneyed. Mission or core purpose, which is a term I prefer, is about why we do what we do and why anybody should care. That's the Steve Jobs create a cause.
Okay.
Then there's the aspect that people call vision, which is where are we headed? What is our vision of the future? And that's the second component of the bullseye. The why, the core purpose, the where are we headed, and how will we know when we're there is the second component. And the third is, how will we behave en route to getting there? And that is what people have often called values, but which I prefer to call living leadership behaviors, or just living leadership. How will we act our way or behave our way to our vision?
Okay, yes, absolutely. And in my experience, that last one, that I find in organizations that aren't passionate is so deflating, is when we have a spoken set of values or, you know, something people put on plaques around the wall, but then in practice, they're not lived. And it becomes
well,
so deflating.
You know, it's also funny. People tend to write values as if they were writing the Ten Commandments. So they have these,
yes,
you know, very magisterial-sounding values, honesty, integrity, fair play, justice for all, motherhood, apple pie, all of that. And, you know, that's fine. And, you know, it's hard to argue against them, but they don't really say anything. And what I always do with my clients is say, I respect that those are your values, as in things you ultimately value. Tell me, though, in the tissue of the everyday, how you're going to need to behave as a derivative of those values, but actual behaviors. And then when somebody says, I will call a person on something if I disagree with them, not mutter about it in the hallway. Or if I get an idea, I commit to trying to make the idea better rather than to shoot it down. Or I will ensure that a customer never complains about the same thing twice and that we learn from each complaint.
Yes.
Or whatever. Now, I'm not saying those are ideal. I'm just giving those as examples. But the thing is, they pass two tests. One, they are so tangible, they smack you in the face. Mm-hmm. And number two, you can easily see when someone is doing it or not doing it. And
right.
Whereas for honesty, integrity, it's very hard to say, I don't believe you're an honest person. It's very hard to challenge someone that existentially.
Sure, sure.
But if somebody says, I will call you on an issue rather than mutter about it in the hallway, and they didn't, and they did mutter about it in the hallway, you can say, look, for whatever reason you didn't keep to that commitment, we need to discuss this. And then you have a robust dialogue.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you know, in my work with clients, I have at times asked them, you know, I don't want to know the values. I'm going to observe what your behaviors are to see if there's a match.
Yeah, I mean, and I sometimes will, you know, in the interest of what Marshall Goldsmith so brilliantly termed feed forward rather than feed back. Now, if they're in a quagmire of denial, I think that's a brilliant expose, because then one can say, well, here are your values in action. Now show me what you've written and watch them squirm. The other is that when you know they're dysfunctional, but they don't want to necessarily say it, then I think one can practice feed forward by saying, okay, let's draw a line in the sand. What are the behaviors we commit to being having observed from this point onwards? And okay. Will you all sign up for them and agree to be held accountable? And there's a sigh of relief, a weight leaves their shoulders, because while you can't unspill spilled milk, you can take a stand for inventing the future.
Yes, that's right. Now, Omar, through all the nine passion liberators, I was wondering if there were some fundamental underlying principles that served as kind of the denominator of all of them. And if so, what were they, and why are these commonalities so powerful?
I think that's a very good question. I think there are some commonalities, spoken or unspoken, throughout them. One is that they all have something to do with how we communicate with ourselves or with each other.
Okay.
So it's about either self-communication in terms of mastering our own energy, our thoughts, our responses, and most of them are about how you interact or project that to other people and help amplify capability and passion rather than being a passion killer yourself. So the quality of communication is one. I think the second wick that runs through them is the need to face facts and then transform those facts.
Okay.
So leadership is not about just creativity without facing what is, because you may be creative in irrelevant, tangential, or inappropriate ways. But it's not just about resigning yourself to facing facts, because then you're not changing anything. There's no leadership contribution. There's nothing transformative. So
sure.
It's about facing facts and transforming them. That's the second wick that runs through a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is shared accountability with other people.
Okay.
And whether that's in terms of coaching, whether that's in terms of mutual accountability dialogues, as I've spoken about in some of the Passion Liberators, whether it's about deploying and releasing talent to its full capability. But those are the three. It's the quality of communication and relationships. It's about facing and then transforming facts and reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about shared accountability and how we can create accountability-rich dialogues, relationships, and interactions.
Okay. And Omar, so as a manager or an executive, if I'm interested in further liberating the passion of my organization and I want to build a coalition of my peers to help me do this, what kind of steps would I need to take to garner that consolidated effort to liberate the passion of the whole organization?
I think you do a number of things. One of the things I do just to break people in to this adventure is to have them list the passion killers that most riddle the organization. And
okay.
You can do that through a survey. You can do it through focus groups. You can do it through dialogues at various organizational levels. And I always tell people that list the passion killers into two, those that we consider technical, i.e. there's a policy that's stupid, or there's a choking bit of bureaucracy, or, you know, and those are not irrelevant. By technical, I don't mean secondary, but they fall into one camp where you simply will take a look at what's the cost of changing this, or what are
okay.
the ripple effects of shifting it. And the others are what we might call the adaptive passion killers, which are passion killers that, in order to change, requires an adaptation of behavior.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So if you look at two sets of passion killers in your organization or team, depending on the slice of the organization you're working on initially, and the way I define passion killers, I say, list those things that inhibit the full deployment of your discretionary effort, your potential, and your enthusiasm towards delivering the goals of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And from feeling totally fulfilled while doing so.
Okay.
So it's both about delivery and personal fulfillment. It's both and, not either or. And people list the technical and they list the adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great way then to prioritize something to begin work on. If you highlighted the most pernicious technical ones that you feel, you can change without inordinate cost or business disruption. Now, some of them may be pernicious that you should change them even at great cost and business disruption just because they're undermining the integrity of the organization. But assuming you don't have something quite that diabolical or quite that invasive, then you can do that. And then if you pick a few of the adaptive ones and go to work on them, what that does is it shows people that this is worth doing, that it makes a difference, that the upsurge in engagement more than repays any emotional, financial, or other investment you may make. And then it's very possible to really begin with each of the 9 passion liberators to make sure people on all of the teams know who they're on a team with, to set the right bullseye, to start radical conversations going up and so to basically have some quality control about the kinds of conversations we have, to face possibility and transform, etc. So all the way through, you can literally follow the 9 passion liberators as a set of initiatives that you could take, each enabling the other. Or you could look at all 9 of them and say, you know what, 5 of these were pretty good at, 4 of these were terrible at, so I'm just going to focus on those. All of that's possible. But I would start by looking at and making visible in a shared way the passion killers.
Okay, sure. And it sounds to me that probably it's going to be the adaptive or the behavioral passion killers that are going to probably be the hardest to change relative to the technical ones.
Absolutely right. In fact, what happens is people will typically get continuously improved. Most quality efforts deal with technical improvements. And the adaptive ones are put aside into we'll get to those once we've dealt with the technical ones. What ends up happening instead is they morph and create new technical passion killers. Because the root of most of the technical deficits are the adaptive problems.
Okay.
Not all. There are exceptions, but a lot of them, because many times I think our corporate pathologies are simply a printout of our private pathologies as leaders.
Okay. Now, Omar, I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, about 2 specific passion killers that I see a lot of organizations struggle with, and that is diversity and inclusion and a lack of a meritocracy.
Yep.
And I was wondering, what passion liberator or combination of passion liberators a leader should try to implement in order to move their organization into one that is more diverse and inclusive and more focused on rewarding achievement?
Well, I think that if you take the diversity and inclusion aspect, I would first then make sure that's on my bullseye.
Okay.
I would then make sure that the teams that we put together are truly, that you put some quality control into the kinds of teams you're going to assemble. And I don't mean to fit a quota, but I mean genuinely diverse, not superficially diverse, but diverse in meaningful ways. And that means perhaps in terms of background, but also certainly in terms of paradigms and reflexes, and work styles. And to then ensure that you build teams that can have the radical conversations we talk about, because it is by those radical conversations and, of course, the practice of intimacy, intimacy, that we create inclusivity, we make them into a real team, and we tap the benefit of diversity.
Yes.
Then you can use other passion liberators like Provoking the Future, which is all about how you can move from managing today to inventing tomorrow. You can do that because you won't have to worry so much about thinking out of the box because you'll have so many different boxes on your team that no one limiting approach will prevail. And hopefully by a collision of all these paradigms, you know, you'll produce something creative. So it'll be creative contention and creative jostling. But the core is put it on the bullseye, build teams that are composed that way, practice intimacy or helping them get to know who each other are with respect and with clarity, and then engender a culture of radical conversations. When we come to the meritocracy aspect, I think the final passion liberator we talk about, coaching growth, is really, really important, because to me what happens is that the biggest sin of performance management is that people don't know where they stand or why they stand where they stand. And coaching needs to be a real-time endeavor because, you know, there's an old saw in the management consulting coaching industry, which I think is apropos, that nothing you hear in a performance review should ever be a surprise.
Absolutely, yes.
And the reason for that, if you think about it, is because if it's important enough to be mentioned, then it was important enough to be raised when it occurred and for coaching to have been given. If it wasn't important enough to be coached at that time, then why mention it long after somebody can do anything about it? And so I think that you build a meritocracy by, one, having an organization committed to their bullseye, having metrics that relate to that bullseye, and providing the real-time coaching and accountability necessary so that anyone who can improve does improve, and everybody is then able to understand why they have or haven't met their expectations. Hopefully also, if some of the coaching involves radical conversations, people will have set some of the goals, co-set the goals with their leaders.
Sure.
And therefore they'll own them, and then they can't say, oh, this was just an inappropriate expectation.
Right.
And there's one other, when we talk about taking accountability as one of the passion liberators, we talk about having a shared results conversation, you and your boss, where you say, look, if we looked ahead of the next performance period, look back from that to today, what would need to have happened for you to be wowed by my contribution? And then the leader, having shared that, asks, and what do you need from me to deliver that? And that becomes a coaching contract.
Yes.
So I think if you pull those levers, get the bullseye known, have ongoing real-time coaching, have some radical conversations through which the goals are set regarding which you'll be providing the coaching, and make sure there's a mutual accountability built in where the leader has to also offer certain leadership, then I think you'll create a meritocratic culture. And one in which people have every chance to succeed, which is what we want.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Omar, before we close, you have a website, and it's www.sensei-international.com. That provides additional resources on how organization leaders can liberate their employees' passion. Would you tell us a bit about the website and its resources?
Sure. One, I'd encourage your listeners also to check in circa February, March, because the website is going to be even better. It'll be new and improved. But already, if you go onto the website under How We Can Help, you'll see some streaming video of me describing some of the support that we offer and our take on leadership and liberating passion and coaching and a variety of things, so they can get that information. There are numerous articles posted on there. There is a free newsletter that people can subscribe to, which goes out to over 4,500 CEOs and leaders each month.
Oh, wow.
There is a link to a blog I occasionally contribute to, which is www.theglobalconsultant.net. which is based on a book I wrote with best-selling author Alan Weiss, who wrote Million Dollar Consulting. This is called The Global Consultant, which teaches consultants how to become global consultants, and a host of other things. So, in fact, the Global Consultant blog, I've just posted about that quite terrifying incident of the Delta flight coming in from Amsterdam. And what we might learn from that relative to leadership and communication.
Okay, great.
So some fairly topical things are posted on there. I'm not one of those bloggers who every day has to tell people I've been to the mall but occasionally it is worth checking in on. There's usually several each month that may be worth a look.
Great, great. Well, thank you. Well, Omar, I also want to thank you for your time and sharing your insights on creating a workplace environment that energizes and engages employees. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed Liberating Passion for the depth of insight and also very specifically for the rich examples that you share in the book that really bring to life the concepts that you present. I'd highly recommend Liberating Passion to all our listeners. And, you know, I hope that they'll pick up a copy of the book, but more importantly, that they'll put into practice the principles that you share to further energize their workforce. So thank you again for joining us.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I would like to personally thank Omar Khan for being with us today and sharing his insights on energizing and engaging employees. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. You can find more information about Omar Khan and Liberating Passion at www.sensei-international.com. Until next time, so long.